supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
The family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
Welcome to Voices in the Family. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Dan Gottlieb. As American troops prepare to reduce their presence in Iraq, some Iraqis who worked with the Americans are fearing for their lives. Many people who interpreted for the troops or provided intelligence are now being threatened by extremists in their own neighborhoods and homes. The story we're about to hear is one woman's story, but it sheds light on the plight of thousands. Philadelphia lawyer Elena Park with Cozen O'Connor recently received a prestigious American Bar Association award for her pro bono work for immigrants. One of the reasons she received this award was her efforts to help a young Iraqi woman named Alia Aboud. The story that connects the two is about war, chance, tough choices, loss, and dedication. It starts with former U.S. Congressman and Philadelphia lawyer Patrick Murphy.
Alia and I met 8 years ago in the summer of 2003. I was a captain with the 82nd Airborne Division as part of the invasion force, and we were stationed in South Central Baghdad. And Alia became one of the first, if not the first, female interpreter that the country had.
And so you hired her? How did that come about?
Yeah, well, she started working with our combat brigade team, and then she was assigned to the team that I led, the BOLT team. It's a Brigade Operational Law Team. So Alia was with us every step of the way. Every time we left what we call the wire at a forward operating base, she'd be in that convoy with us.
So tell me a little bit about your life before that day. What were you doing? What were you up to?
I just graduated in 2003 from college. So by the time I graduated like 6 months before the war. So before the war, I was a student. I graduated looking for a job. The war came out and I was looking for a job, and there was no jobs at the time. And my brother was walking one day and he heard that the U.S. Army is just looking for interpreters, and they take you and they pay you like $10 a day, I think, and they used to jump in the car and go with them, and they get done in the end of the day and come back. And my brother was like, well, why don't you just go? You know, we need the money and you want to work, so just go. So I just walked to the place where the U.S. Army was, and I was like, I need a job, and I got a job.
And where had you learned English?
In school. In Iraq, we study English starting the fifth grade, and we go all the way to the college.
So Patrick mentioned you were the first woman working for the American forces. Mm-hmm. How did that feel to you? Did it feel very unusual that you were doing this? You said your brother encouraged you to go for it.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting because the first day I started working, I literally was sitting in a room and soldiers were coming, sneaking, looking at me and going back. And because I was the first probably Iraqi woman they saw without a veil or without, you know, I was wearing just a regular jeans and I was sitting and I was speaking English to everybody. So it was kind of, you know, I wasn't sure. I was like, okay, it's a job, you know, who cares? I'm translating things, I'm helping people. I was pretty happy about it.
And what about your neighbors and your friends? What did they say about it?
Some people said it's okay. Some people were like, oh, you shouldn't do that. But in the beginning of the war, everybody wanted this job because there was nothing else to do. So if you got the job, you're lucky. And you were safe at the time. I used to like walk every day or like, you know, take a cab and go there every day. It's pretty easy. So I didn't have a problem in the beginning.
So the fact that you were working for the Americans at the time did not create a problem at that point?
No. I mean, some people, yes, looked at me in a way like, you know, what are you doing? You're a woman. Why do you work? Why do you work for the U.S. Army? It's like, it's not acceptable in the culture, you know. I'm not, and especially I wasn't ever, like, I never wear the hijab or I never was very religious, and not my family as well. I mean, we believe in God, we're Muslims, and we're very good Muslim, practicing Muslim, but we never were, you know, strict. So it was kind of okay, other than people just give you some dirty looks, but that's it.
And Patrick, describe a bit what you did on a day-to-day basis. What was a typical day like?
Sure. Well, our sector was South Central Baghdad, which was a Sunni and Shia neighborhood. It was probably one of the most dangerous places in the country. And it was 138-degree heat in the summer of 2003, and we had the whole spectrum of responsibilities of prosecuting criminals, some that we saw as war criminals in Iraq, and then making sure that we had military justice within our combat brigade team. And Aliyah, who was with us every step of the way, was part of our team. And, you know, we treated her like a little sister, and we were very protective of her and of her family. And I know one of the things that she helped us with was one of the prosecutions of two religious leaders in Baghdad. That put her and our team in harm's way. We took down one of the top lieutenants of Muqtaqba al-Sadr. Muqtaqba al-Sadr is a Shia religious leader. Sadr City is named after his father. He spent the last few years in Iran, but is back now in Iraq. And one of his top lieutenants was Sheikh Moyad, who threatened to kill American soldiers and tried to rally soldiers and kept weapons in his mosque and was not a very good person.
And what did that mean for you? Talk a little bit how you remember that.
I just felt like, you know, I should help. You know, maybe it wasn't, maybe until this moment, I don't feel comfortable talking about it, but it needed to be done and somebody needed to be there, and I decided I wanted to help.
Was there any backlash because of that specific?
No, I don't think so at the time.
Remember when they had the big protest with hundreds of people and we had the line? That was because we arrested him. Do you want me to give you that back?
Yeah. I don't remember that.
So we took down this top lieutenant of Muqtaqba al-Sadr, and what they did was, because we were in Al-Shi Baghdad, South Central Baghdad, they bussed people in from outside of our district to protest. There were hundreds of Iraqis in the streets protesting, saying, how could you basically arrest a religious leader? And our argument was, well, if a religious leader is committing crimes, he's going to get prosecuted. I would go on. We were on national TV, which was Aliyah's voice. It was me talking, but Aliyah's voice on national TV talking about why we did that. And I talked about, here's the charge sheet, and this is our evidence. And it got so bad that General Dempsey from the 1st Armored Division, now the Chief of Staff of the United States Army, brought some of his tanks down because the protesters got so aggressive.
So were you scared at this time?
You always get scared because this is not a joke. When you're talking about you going out in a mission, maybe nobody will see you, but when you're talking about a religious leader, that is not a joke. It's never a joke. And nobody showed my picture, I think, in the video when I was translating for him, but people recognized my voice. And people came to me, and I'm like, was that your voice? And I'm like, no, it wasn't my voice. But a lot of people just recognize it. And, you know, at the moment, I felt like, wow, this is interesting. But, you know, I just kept doing it. I just didn't stop. Yes, I was scared, but I didn't stop. Not yet.
We're listening to the story of Aliyah Aboud on today's Voices in the Family. She was one of the first female Iraqis to work for the American forces. In 2003, she started to work for a team of soldiers led by Patrick Murphy, who later became the first Iraq veteran elected to Congress. He now works as a lawyer for Fox Rothschild in Philadelphia. Aliyah described the growing tensions between the Iraqi people and the American soldiers, which made her work as a translator more dangerous. But the everyday tasks of her job and going out on patrols were also becoming more dangerous.
It's always scary because there's all these ambush and bombs in the street, and I remembered my prayers every day that, please God, if I ever die, I want to die in one piece. I don't want to be, you know, so many pieces that people cannot find me, and if it ever happened, I just want to die. I don't want to be a handicap. I don't want to lose two legs or two hands. It was tough. At the time, you know, when I started working, it was easy. It was safe. But like 6 months or month later, it started to be really serious because people were getting to the point where like, okay, this is not acceptable, you know. This is not something our religious allowed. We're not ruling our own country. What's going on? So, yeah, there was so many moments where I was very scared.
How about you? Were you scared for her?
I was scared for her because she was a member of our team. And yet we were at a forward operating base working 20 hours a day, 7 days a week in 138-degree heat. And it was the turning point in the war where the roadside bombs were killing the majority of American soldiers were being killed by these roadside bombs or IEDs. And to lead convoys almost every day outside the wire, two or three vehicles at a time, oftentimes in a Humvee without any doors, let alone armor. And to know that there's a civilian, you know, Iraqi young woman, a translator on our team, who was there and was just as much in harm's way as any other paratrooper, weighed on us. And I'm sure, I know, weighed on her. But our team made sure that we did everything to protect her, and she showed more courage than most folks I've ever met in my life to be there with us.
Did you lose guys on your team during that time?
We had lost 19 paratroopers in the 2nd Brigade Combat Team in the 82nd Airborne Division. And, you know, the sector that we were responsible for in Iraq, which was South Central, the Al-Rishi District, had 1.5 million Iraqis. And it was only 3,500 of us. That's how shorthanded we were. And we didn't have a lot of interpreters or translators. And, you know, Aliyah was really a godsend to our team because we couldn't have done these high-level prosecutions if it wasn't for her.
When did you start becoming really worried for Aliyah, for her safety, for her family's safety?
Well, I know when we prosecute these two religious leaders, we knew that the danger of Aliyah and some of our witnesses against them were really in harm's way.
Talk a bit about when you realized that the work you were doing could become dangerous for you outside of the threats that we've already discussed of being part of a military operation.
We, as a group of interpreters, it was so funny in the beginning because we will go every day, you know, we meet, we talk. It wasn't just me, it was a group of us, maybe 12, and we will stand and we will, like, you know, we will joke about, oh, maybe we'll be all kidnapped. We will, you know, we will cost a fortune for who was going to kidnap us, and we all laugh about it. But then, like, 6 months later, it wasn't a joke. People start to be kidnapped, people I was with, people I saw every day. People were found dead. It started to be scary. It got really serious for me when me and my cousin live next door, and my cousin's house was attacked with a grenade. And they found a letter saying you should quit because both of my cousins used to work for the U.S. Army, but in a different place. So that's when I felt it was getting, you know, a little bit serious. But I was like, well, maybe it's just, you know, somebody who want to scare us, but he's not really serious, you know. So, yes, I was scared, but I didn't quit at that time.
Why not?
I don't know if I was just stupid not to, or I was just young, and I thought it's not serious. At the same time, more like this is probably the reasons I figure out maybe 5 years later. But of course, the one reason that I didn't quit was, I was doing something good. I was doing the right thing. And I had talked to my dad about things I was doing. And I said, you know, Dad, I have a question for you. You're my guide. And he's like, yeah. And I said, well, you know, I'm doing this and that. And am I really doing something wrong by helping foreigners who are here in my country without our people will? Am I doing wrong or right? Is it wrong or right? I don't know. I'm confused. And my dad said, it doesn't matter what religion you are. It doesn't matter what you do, as long as you do it for the right purpose. So you are helping. I used to work with Patrick in helping people get in compensation about losses they have, like a car accident or anything. And one time I went to my dad again, and I'm like, you know, those people bring, you know, false claims, but they are my people. And I'm telling the foreigners that those people don't deserve money. And, you know, I don't know. I feel I have obligation toward my people, but I have a job and I want to be honest with the people I work with. And my dad again said, if you're doing the right thing, you do it for everybody. You just don't do it for one person just because you prefer that one person. If you're honest, you're always honest in every job you have, in every level you go to. You know, that's a big reason why I had the courage to continue doing what I did.
And then you left.
We were on rotation for a unit to go home. And, you know, we had tried to accomplish a lot of good when we were there, but we also knew that Aliyah and others were going to be behind. And it's something that weighed heavily on my heart when I came home, because it was bittersweet. I mean, when I came home in 2004 from Iraq, my team came home alive, even though we lost 19 guys in our unit over there. But I knew that one of our teammates wasn't coming home, and that was Alia.
And Alia, did you continue to work for the Americans at the time?
Yes, I did. I worked with the team that replaced Patrick, but they didn't like me as much. The captain who replaced Patrick, literally one time, we sit in an office and I translate all the paperwork. And so one of the people walked in and they tried to close the door, and he like jumped and opened the door. And I was like surprised. I'm like, what's wrong? Why did you open the door? He's like, I don't want to be in the same room with my enemy with the door closed. And I was like, I got really offended, you know, like, I'm working for you. I've been working for a year and you can't just tell me I'm your enemy. And he's like, you know, it doesn't matter if you work for me, you're still my enemy. Your people are just cowards. They hide and hit us. I just transferred from the legal department to a different group and I kept working for a while until we received letters telling us to quit, otherwise we will be, you know, killed. And at that time, I took it seriously. That was serious. You know, there were bullets in the letters, and they were in my name, in my brother's name, in my cousin's name, and my uncle's as well. And they gave us 3 days to quit. Before the end of the 3 days, my uncle was assassinated. So I knew that was serious. That was the point where I was, okay, I need to quit. Not because I was scared of being killed. Being killed is not the problem. Dying is not a problem. But I'm a woman. I don't want to be kidnapped and raped. And that was what they used to do. They don't kill you right away. They kidnap you. They take a ransom. Then they rape you. Then they torture you. Then they kill you. So it doesn't matter what you do, but that's the process. So my two cousins went back to work. And 2 days later, both of them were kidnapped.
Did they find your cousins?
Yes. We had to pay, like, really, really big amount of money. We almost paid $45,000 to get them out, which is, in Iraq, is, like, a huge amount of money. They had, like, her family almost, and my family, we sold everything we had. Yes, we get them out, and for a long time they were not doing well.
And when did you decide you wanted to try to leave Iraq and come to the United States?
Well, I left Iraq right after my two cousins were released, because when they were released, they were tortured, and they were told I was going to be next, you know. And of course, it's even worse for me, because even when the good thing, they were not, like, you know, raped, or they were not, like, killed, or, you know, they both wear hijab and cover very well, and I don't. And I was told, literally, like, they had a message for me, like, tell her for all these things she is gonna be next. And when my two cousins were released, second day we were out in Jordan.
That's Alia Aboud, a young Iraqi woman who worked for the American forces as an interpreter. We'll find out what happened after Alia's escape to Jordan. Later on, we'll hear from a volunteer who's working with Iraqi refugees like Alia. I'm Maiken Scott, in for Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices in the Family here on WHYY.
Academic Urology is pleased to support WHYY. Providing integrated urologic care throughout the Philadelphia region, Academic Urology brings together 36 urologists at 16 office locations. More information at academicurology.com.
Hi, Mike McGrath, host of You Bet Your Garden here, inviting you to join us for our next web chat, where we'll cover garlic planting, fun with pansies and fall greens, and all the great parts of the second season of gardening. The web chat takes place live Wednesday, September 21st at noon at whyy.org/garden.
Supporting WHYY, Trader Joe's, a neighborhood grocery store with a variety of seafood and meats for the grill, meat and vegetable marinades, and lemonades. Locations and more at TraderJoe's.com.
Mm-hmm. And welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Dan Gottlieb. We've been listening to the story of Alia Aboud, a young Iraqi woman from Baghdad who worked for the American forces as an interpreter. After receiving death threats and after members of her family were killed and kidnapped, Alia escaped to Jordan. Patrick Murphy, the army captain who had first hired Alia, had returned to the U.S. and started working as a lawyer for Cozen O'Connor in Philadelphia. He asked a new colleague, Elena Park, to help Alia.
I received an email from Patrick. I did not know him. He was a new associate, basically saying, you know, look, Elaine, I heard you practice immigration law, and I have a friend who's back in Iraq, and very, very briefly told me the situation by email. And I said, sure, you know, give me the information, and we'll go from there. So then I started an email conversation, not only with Patrick, but with Alia. And what struck me was, you know, she seemed so eloquent. I saw pictures of her, and I was just, you know, because you have this image of just Iraqis as just a mass of people. You don't distinguish them individually. And when I just saw this young woman who was so, she just looked so bright that I just became even more and more compelled. And then legally, I tried to do everything I could to help her and to get her over here.
When did you start that process?
Patrick emailed me in April of 2005, and literally it took about 2 years before we finally got her over here. In the interim, I think we had looked into maybe 3 or 4 different kinds of petitions. At the time when Patrick first contacted me, Congress was discussing but had not passed the bill for special immigrants, and it was only about a year later that the special immigrant visa was created as a category, but with only 50 slots per year. So the wait time or the priority date was, there was a backlog from the get-go. Since then, the laws have changed, but just from the very beginning, it was very, very stressful, very frustrating. There weren't a lot of options. The UN had literally closed their doors for Iraqi refugees at that time. I'm sure it's changed now, but just at the time that we were working, for some reason, they just said, we're not processing any Iraqi refugees, period, so go away. That was the message. Finally, we got in contact with a woman named Janice. I'll just use her first name. Through her connection, we decided after, you know, some time, we're going to sponsor Alia for a student visa, which was almost the last resort. It was the last resort.
Alia, where were you this whole time?
Oh, with the process?
While you were waiting to come to the United States.
I was between Jordan and Baghdad. So I was going back and forth because you have to leave. For you to be a legal resident in Jordan in a tourist visa, you have to leave the country every 3 months and re-enter. Otherwise, you'd be illegal and you can be deported anytime. And I didn't want to be in this such situation, so I would take a trip to Baghdad every 3 to 4 months and come back.
And were you scared to go back to Baghdad?
Yeah. First of all, I was scared just for the fact that what happened with me, and I was scared because I wasn't able to afford a flight ticket every time I go, so I would take the road, and the road wasn't safe, and, you know, there was a lot of kidnapping, stealing, and killing, and one time we were stopped, we were a big group, I went with my friend, with a family, friends of us, because I never travel by myself, I'm always, like, worried, because you're a woman, you're not supposed to, and we were stopped by a group of armed people. Probably they were waiting for somebody specific, but, you know, we were stopped by them. They had all kind of weapons that you can imagine that a human being can carry. You cannot even see their eyes. They were so tied up. Their face was so covered so well that you cannot even see their eyes. And they stopped us. I remember the driver had the music on, and in a minute, because the driver very familiar with the situation, he took the tape off, put another tape of Quran, and asked everybody to put their hijab, and we were stopped. It was literally 4 seconds. They look at the car, they saw kids and the family, and they let us out. But this 4 seconds were like 10 minutes. Like, it was so scary because you just saw people with a lot of weapons. You don't know what those people are going to do. So that's what I had to go through every time I went back and forth between Jordan and Iraq.
And Elena, how did you stay in touch with Aliyah during this long process?
It was basically through email. I mean, thank God for email because she was pretty responsive. I think she always tried to find an internet cafe or some place where she could email me. And so, you know, from time to time I would, you know, not hear from her and then I would get anxious. I literally felt every time I heard a news story or something about Iraq or Jordan or someone getting killed, my heart kind of squeezed inside me because I felt this personal connection with someone over there. So I would email her and say, are you okay? Sometimes it was just, you know, I have no legal progress, but just, are you okay? And she would email me back. And I tried to help her feel hopeful when sometimes I didn't. So I would look at the situation and I would be banging my head against the desk, but I would email her and say, Aliyah, don't give up.
Did you just want to scream at the injustice of all of this, just how hard it was to get her in after she had done so much?
Aliyah's story and situation is the textbook asylum refugee case. There is no gray area in her case, but the fact that there are so many roadblocks, it was very, very frustrating. It was very frustrating, but, you know, I couldn't be frustrated to the point of feeling hopeless and, well, that's the way it is and that's the way our government is. And so I tried to be hopeful. I tried to strategize and think creatively, think outside the box, you know, because, okay, it's frustrating, but it's no point just lying down and saying, well, that's it. And, you know, being all depressed and bitter about it. So I think it's so important in these types of cases, if one way doesn't work, try another way. Think outside the box is what I tried to do, and I think that's what worked in the end, to really think outside the box and, you know, to have fate or luck because of the situation. How she finally got her student visa was, you know, we were at the end of our line, basically, in last resort, and she was denied for the student visa two times at the embassy. And then at that point, we just said, okay, we're leaving it up to the heavens above, because right now we did everything we could, and everyone had their, you know, fingers and toes crossed. And finally, on the third time, she was approved, and that was a happy day. It was a happy day for me personally, too.
So tell me about when you left. When was that? And then describe how you left and how you came here.
When I finally got my visa, which is something I didn't even, at the time it was just like, I'm never going to get this visa because all the last experience. And I got all my paper done, you know, after I got my visa and they sent me the email, I went through not being able to enter Jordan to pick up my visa, and not being able to send my passport because it's not safe to send it like in FedEx through two countries. And so I had to go through that. And it took me a month, really, three trips and a lot of money back and forth to Jordan trying to get in. So finally get in, and the guy I bribed calls me back trying to get more money. And, you know, where's your passport? I'm like, you know what? My passport's in the embassy right now, and I don't need your help anymore. But, you know, people, you know, I harass you for all kind of reasons. And the day I received my passport, got my ticket, and I was out. I landed in Philadelphia, and very thankful for two ladies who were helping me at the time. One of them helped, you know, offered me housing for a while, and she was a very, very nice lady. And I'm going to mention her first name is Jody. And another lady who had to do a lot of work with Elena and me to get me to the state, and her name is Janice, and she did help a lot of people just out of help. She never got paid for anything. She never, you know, knew the people. She was just trying to help as much as she can, and I appreciate, you know, landing there, seeing two ladies, very nice ladies, waiting for me, so I don't feel very strange.
And that was, when did you land here?
June 16, 2007.
And when did you get to meet Elena?
I think I met her a week later, a couple of days. She came and took me out for just like a ride. And it was very interesting what she said at the time. I still remember she said, I came here and I didn't know anybody. And I'm sure you're going through the same thing. So I just want you to know that you have friends here. Even though I'm not your lawyer anymore, but I'm your friend. And I appreciate that. That was very, you know, helpful, because I felt very scared at the time. You know, I'm in a different country. I don't know anybody. I'm in a stranger family. You know, everything was just strange.
Talk about that day when you finally got to meet Elia.
I felt like I had known her for a long time, and I guess I had known her for a long time. So when I met her, it was just the fruit of, you know, I guess our labors. And I was just struck by how, I guess I had this, or people have this image of foreign lands, Iraq, just kind of very foreign sounding. But when we met, we just started talking about the humidity in our hair and, you know, just very down to earth. It was just very down to earth. And we did become friends.
And Elia, what's your status now? What kind of a visa are you on now?
I have a green card right now. I applied. Elena, of course, helped me to meet some friends, and I applied for asylum, got my asylum, and I have a green card right now. In a year, hopefully, I'll become a citizen. So I'm totally legal, if I can say.
And what kind of work do you do now?
I finished my master's degree in international peace and conflict resolutions, and I work in an NGO helping refugees. Hopefully, in the future, I would be able to work with more people, with asylee, with refugees, to do more work, you know, to try to improve the situation. You know, a big thing is when those refugee and asylee arrive, what happened to them? This is a very depressing situation for a lot of them, and I'm trying to, you know, get involved in helping them in this situation or do anything I can. It's very tough, you know. I'm meeting all kind of people, and they're from my own community. A lot of Iraqis now arriving on refugee visa, and a lot of them going back, and a lot of them just depressed, and a lot of them without a job, you know. It's just hard, you know. So
talk about those you left behind. Who in your family is still in Iraq?
Most of my family is still in Iraq. And I wonder if all the refugee and SIV that coming to the U.S. and, you know, sometimes I wonder how they even chose their refugees, because if my cousin who was kidnapped and who her father was assassinated, plus her brother was assassinated after that, could not get a special immigrant visa or a refugee status, how does those people get their refugee status? You know, I left a whole family out there. My cousin who was kidnapped and tortured because she worked for the army, knocked on every door, and Elena was trying to help her as well. And if I was lucky to come here, she was never lucky. She never got a refugee status. She never got SIV visa. We couldn't even get her a humanitarian parole, and she's still there, you know.
Your father?
My father passed away last year, unfortunately.
I'm assuming you couldn't go.
No, I couldn't. That was one of the price I paid. I think this is the price I paid for being here, you know, not being able to attend my dad's funeral, you know. And just, you know, he disappeared in a minute. I talked to him one day, and he died the second day. So,
and your mother?
My mother and my brothers live all in Baghdad. God bless them and protect them. I try to call them all the time if there is anything happen. I hope nothing's happening. I'm not gonna have to pay any other price for being here.
Do you think you'll ever be able to go back?
Oh, I will definitely go back. I will go back to fix what has been messed up one day. I don't know when, but people need to go back. People with education need always to be helpful, but I don't know when or how. I don't know what kind of situation is still very bad there, and I don't know how safe it will be to go.
The fear that you lived with when you were still in Iraq and then going back and forth, Has that followed you here in any way, or do you feel safe here?
I don't think anybody will feel safe after going through this. I cannot even enjoy fireworks because they always remind me of war. I mean, I've been through the whole war. I didn't leave any. I lost a lot of friends, and I lost a lot of family members, and friends who were young and full of life, and they were not doing anything wrong. They were just willing to live. They didn't want to be murderer. They didn't want to be thieves. They didn't want to be anything other than just work hard to get money to survive, you know. Regardless if you work with the army to help your country or not, the first motion is people need money to live, you know. They need money to survive. And those people were, okay, I need money to survive. I got a job. But in this job, I'm doing a good thing. I'm helping. I should not be dead for what I'm doing. And they were dead. Some of them were tortured. Some of them, you know, got problems. They didn't die, but they lost a leg or a hand or any of these, you know, tragedies. And it was, you know, I don't think I will ever forget that.
How has it been living here?
It's been tough. I don't know. I mean, it depends because people are different. You will meet people who totally understand, and who you will meet people who totally accuse you of being terrorist and Muslim and, you know, and all kind of like horrible things. And I have to say, in the last 4 years, it never was easy to live here. I've been surviving hardly for the last 4 years, you know. I've been working and going to school and trying to improve myself, but I'm not going anywhere, you know. I'm there. I go online. I try to apply for jobs. I probably applied for 2,000, 3,000 jobs. I don't even get an email back, if, you know. And it's tough, you know. You meet people who always see you as a foreigner, and because you're an Arab, because you're a Muslim, you know, you never have a chance to work for them. And people are judgmental. But not all of them, of course. Some of them very, very nice, and some of them very judgmental. But I have to say, the last 4 years was never easy, and I don't think it's yet easy.
And Elena, finally, you did all this work on your own time, and you do a lot of that work. Did this reinforce how important it is? And talk a bit also about your personal history of immigration, why you like to help other immigrants.
So I'm basically a child of immigrants. My parents are from Korea and immigrated to Canada, and then I came from Canada to the U.S., so I'm basically an immigrant too. And so I have a personal, not only interest, but compassion for people who are new to the United States. And I also have a personal and professional vested interest, I guess, in helping those who really want to come to the United States and just make a better life for themselves.
Talk about the award you just got. Was it nice to get that kind of recognition and to also be able to talk a bit about why you do this work and the people you do it for?
Yeah, I mean, of course, it was nice to get the award. I did feel a little, you know, self-conscious because a lot of this work was done, you know, it wasn't publicized. It was more a personal, you know, close family members. Like, obviously, my husband knew. And so my happiest moment was when Alia got to the United States. But, of course, it was nice to be recognized, and especially if it helps spread the word about what people have to go through, that we're so blessed, number one, to be living in this country, and number two, to be legal. And a lot of that is serendipitous. You know, it's because our parents or our grandparents, you know, they came here legal or illegally, but finally we're legal. But it's really just a luck of the draw. You know, we got here first, we're legal. But, you know, there are so many people who really view the United States as, it is a place where you can build your dreams and build your life, and I just really respect that.
We just heard the voice of Philadelphia lawyer Elena Park. She's with Cozen O'Connor and volunteered her time to help Iraqi translator Alia Aboud to come to the U.S. Now, throughout the interview, Alia mentioned a woman named Janice who helped her not only come to the United States, but once she got here, helped her. And coming up on Voices in the Family, we'll hear from this very Janice. She is a local woman who volunteers for the List Project. That's an organization that helps Iraqis who fear for their lives as American forces reduce their presence. I'm Mike and Scott in for Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices in the Family here on WHYY FM.
Do you have love, time, or resources to help one child? Bethany Christian Services, a national nonprofit adoption agency, envisions a world where every child has a loving family. Since 1944, Bethany has provided adoption and foster care services, licensed in more than 30 states, including Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. To learn ways to care for vulnerable children in our region and around the world, 800-215-0702 or bethany.org. Bethany Christian Services supports WHYY.
Like jazz and gospel, bluegrass is one of America's most distinctive art forms. We'll hear about the man called the father of bluegrass, Bill Monroe, how he turned porch song and field holler into high art. We'll find out next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Mike and Scott in for Dan Gottlieb today. We've been listening to the story of Alia Aboud, a young Iraqi woman who immigrated to the U.S. after her life was threatened for working with American forces and members of her family were kidnapped and assassinated. Many thousands of Iraqis are in similar situations but are not able to get visas. Joining us now is Janice Kelsey. She volunteers as the Philadelphia chapter coordinator with the List Project, which helps Iraqis who worked with the American forces throughout the war. Janice, thank you so much for being on Voices in the Family.
Thank you for having me here, Mike.
And tell me how you first got involved with this kind of work.
Well, back in 2005, I was busy working with IUSA Global Youth Exchange, which is the premier student international student exchange program here in the United States. And they had won the bid to administer a program called the YES Program. It was actually developed by Colin Powell. And at the time, it was under Condoleezza Rice. And I happened to be assigned a 15-year-old Chaldean boy from Baghdad that year. And it was a pleasure meeting him. And he was a wonderful student. And that was my first introduction to what was really going on in Iraq. And he introduced me to that. It was too dangerous for him to go home. We ended up applying for asylum for him and kept him here. I became friends with his mom, and we had a lot of conversations over the internet, and she had asked me to help her older daughter and younger son to get out because there were kidnappings basically going down the street. This was the way for extremists to raise money for, you know, ammunition and guns. So they were very worried as they were getting closer and closer to their home, and I wanted to get visas for these two kids, and my being very naive, didn't know that visas weren't really being issued. We did apply for them and tried to fight our way through. We weren't successful the first time through, and I started doing some research on other ways of doing visas. One was humanitarian parole, and I just trolled around on the internet, and I found an article, and several people were interviewed in there, and it was about how we were not treating our interpreters fairly, and how they had been left behind and were in danger. And I caught the name of Captain Patrick Murphy, who served with the 82nd Airborne. Now that caught my eye too, because my dad was one of the first members of the 82nd Airborne back in World War II. So I read on, and I thought he had helped his two interpreters to get out of Iraq. So I thought, well, you know, it can't be hard to track him down. It says here that he's working as a lawyer in Philadelphia. So I thought, well, I'll go on the internet and track him down. Well, there are many Patrick Murphys in Philadelphia, an Irish Catholic like myself. It's hard to track him down with common names. So I did. I plugged in 82nd Airborne, and sure enough, I found this this Patrick Murphy was running for Congress. And I thought, oh, dear, this man's not going to contact me back. He's too busy. But I tried anyway, and I sent him an email and told him I needed help with these two kids and was really worried about them and scared for their lives. And I also shared with him that my dad happened to be in the 82nd Airborne, and that's what drew me to that article. Well, surprising to me, he responded very quickly, and he said, you know, unfortunately, there's really nothing that I can do for you. I did not get my interpreters out, and I feel horrible that I left them behind. And he told me, you know, when we were serving over there, we officers thought, you know, for sure when, you know, a year was up and if our people were in danger, we would be able to send them to safety. And he wasn't able to. And he said, if I ever needed any help, to give him a call. Well, we sent the kids back through the embassy another time in Jordan, and the boy got through. And then sometime later, the daughter got through, and on that same day that we received that news, I got a phone call from Elena Park. And Elena said, you know, my associate, Patrick Murphy, asked me to give you a call to see how you're doing, see if there's anything we can do to help you. And I said, no, I'm really having a great day. We have two kids with student visas. I'm really thrilled. And she was silent for a while and said, How did you do that?
Oh, so you actually, just to forward ahead a little bit because we have only so little time with you, you actually gave Elena the idea to try a student visa for Alia, which eventually landed her safely in this country.
Exactly.
But so you've been working with other Iraqi refugees since you first started doing this work. And what are you hearing? What's going on? What's on people's minds as the American forces prepare to reduce their presence?
Well, the major concern that's coming from a lot of these interpreters and from officers in the military is that they are going to be in danger when we leave, when the American troops reduce. We are closing bases over there now. As they close these bases, these interpreters are now unemployed. They go home, and they are being targeted. When the British left, they were rounding up the interpreters that served for the British and were murdering them. This is what we fear for interpreters now, and these are the messages that I get from these people, that please help us. They're very concerned that there are so few what are called special immigrant visas. These are for Iraqi citizens who have served with the United States military, and you cannot get these without, you know, can't even work with the military without, you know, stringent background checks. And there are so few of these being issued, it's just strange.
And right now you're also working with a young man who is stuck in Turkey?
Yes, I am. Yes,
so what's his story?
Well, we call him Mark. His story is, and I can't tell you too many details,
right,
because he is in danger. He did work for the American military. He worked for Special Forces. And he did have to run and leave the country. Now, his problem is that he worked on a classified mission and cannot really share any information about that mission. A very loyal person, and will not, you know, will stick with his promise. And you know, this man, he sacrificed so much. He worked for the military. He performed his duties, and for that, his family was murdered. His mother, his father, and his three siblings were murdered. Now, this was a young man. You know, he was probably 25 or 26 when he first started working for the military, and then lost his family.
Mm.
So he's hiding in another country and can never go home.
So this doesn't just affect the many, many thousands of people who directly work with the military. It also affects their families.
Yes, and this is something that a lot of our military people feel horrible about. You know, that it's not just them giving the sacrifice. It's their family members as well.
And just this morning, you received a letter from a captain who is stationed in Iraq.
Yes.
And he wrote to you asking for your help. And I'm wondering if you want to read a short excerpt from that letter.
I will, absolutely. It's right here.
So he's on his second tour of duty.
He's on his second tour of duty. He is from the Philadelphia area, and that's how he found me, was through someone from Philly. Here it says, I would agree with the assessment that the Department of State is putting our linguists at risk, unnecessarily in my opinion, by holding their visas. I have read reports in the media, and I understand the fear of causing a brain drain in Iraq by allowing all the talent to leave, but beyond that fear, I cannot fathom why we would expose our close, avid supporters to more risk. These linguists have risked their lives and their families' lives for close to a decade. We simply cannot turn our back on those who helped our mission and our country for so long. I deployed to Iraq from September 2009 through August 2010. I arrived back in Iraq this past 2011 after 1 year stateside. My linguists, however, never left. They live here. They are in constant risk of being discovered and targeted. To make matters worse, many, if not all, local national linguists have to pay a tax to the Iraqi government for the money they make from defense contracts, meaning their status as a linguist is available to the Iraqi government. I'll allow you to draw your own conclusions on the possibilities of corruption and information sharing, especially considering large blocs in the Iraqi parliament actively and outwardly target American soldiers. What do we think will happen to the linguists when U.S. forces leave?
Yeah, and that's a letter you just received this morning from a captain in the American Army who's trying to enlist your help in getting support. And what are you hearing, Janice? We only have about a minute left, but what kind of, what's the political climate? What are you hearing from elected officials when this topic is being raised?
Well, we are finding a number of people in Congress who are supporting this. I mean, this has been going on. These delays for these SIVs have been going on for a long time. What's happened recently was that two Iraqis who did not come through the SIV program, they had been arrested in Kentucky on charges of plotting to ship weapons to insurgents in Iraq. These people came through the UNHCR program, I believe. We're looking at SIVs. All of these visas have just stopped suddenly for new security procedures. For example, in March, we had only 7 SIVs admitted. In April, only 9. And recently, I really haven't heard of any recently. I'm sure a few have come in, but that's all I've seen so far.
And that's Janice Kelsey. And Janice, with that, unfortunately, we have to stop. She is a volunteer with the Philadelphia chapter of the List Project. And that is a project that helps Iraqis who worked with the American forces during the war. And you can find them online at thelistproject.org. And Janice, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you so much for your work. And next week on Voices in the Family, Dan is back. And our topic will be learning and learning differences. And one of our guests will be Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Philip Schultz. And you can find us online at whyy.org/voices, and you can also take a listen to today's interview there on our website. Our engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is the executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Our intern is Emily Hawes. Jennifer Lynn produces Voices in the Family. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.